Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. If you're arrested and charged with a crime in this country, most likely you'll have two options. Go to jail and wait for trial, or pay the bail the court sets for you. It's fully refundable if you show up, and you can continue with your life until your trial date. Innocent until proven guilty is the guarantee. Chances are, if you can afford to avoid jail, you'll do it. But for those who can't afford it, there is another way, and that is to hire a bail bondsman. You pay a fee, usually 10% of your bail amount, that the bondsman keeps. And as long as you show up for your trial, the bond business gets the bail money back from the state, and they've earned a profit. But is this system preying on poor people? One of today's guests, Mother Jones reporter Shane Bauer, has just released an in-depth article about the corruption of the bail bond business. And it's not only the guys who issue the bonds, but the sureties or insurance companies who back those bonds, he says, are corrupt. They have powerful lobbyists and ties with legislators who make sure that even though bail is not shown to increase the likelihood a defendant will show up for trial, the bail bond system is still in place. Bauer reports that the American Bar Association, the National Association of Counties, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the National District Attorneys Association, and others have condemned commercial bail as a system that discriminates against the poor and places Americans' liberty at the mercy of private businesses. So what do we need to know about the bail bond system and about who's profiting and how it might be reformed? Joining us today is Shane Bauer, who's a reporter with Mother Jones San Francisco Bureau. He covers criminal justice, social justice, and human rights, and his article is in the current edition of Mother Jones. It's Get Out of Jail Free, Lobbyists, Guns, and Money Inside the Shadowy and Very Well-Connected Bail Bonds Industry. Hi, Shane.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by Megan Guevara, who's a consultant with the Pretrial Justice Institute. Megan works with local and state justice systems to develop policies that reduce the likelihood of new crime and maximize taxpayer dollars. She's been working in California since 2007, helping county governments analyze their justice populations and manage the use of jails and community corrections. Hi, Megan. Are you with us?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So for those who don't know how the bail system works, can one of you explain it? Shane, why don't you start us off and Megan can add?
Sure. It's pretty simple. The basic way is, say that you're arrested for drug possession. You get arrested, you typically go to jail, and then go to a hearing where the judge decides your bail, whether how they're going to release you. Usually that's an amount of money. Sometimes it's not. And if the judge sets bail, say $30,000, if you put that money up, you can get out of jail until your trial. When you come back to trial, you get that money back. If you don't have that money, then you either sit in jail until your trial, or you hire a bail bondsman, and the bail bondsman will get you out. He'll essentially promise, the money to the court if you don't appear, and you pay that bail bondsman a 10% fee for his service.
Anything to add to that, Megan? How much discretion do judges have in terms of what the bail is set? Are there set fees, like there are mandatory minimums? How does that work? You there, Megan?
Yes, there are set fees, and in California, it's actually required under statute that each county has a bail bond schedule, and so basically a list of these are the offenses, and this is the amount of bond that should be set for that particular offense. There is some discretion with the judges in terms of those bond amounts, but basically that schedule is the menu that local counties are following. But I would like to add that there is another option that's being used in some parts of California and also in other parts of the country where people are released based on a measured risk to reoffend and are supervised in the community. So rather than it being based on a set amount of bond, they're released with conditions of supervision and under terms that are much more related to their actual risk to reoffend in the community or their risk to fail to appear than the bond system that's just based on their ability to pay or not to pay.
And what counties are doing that kind of system?
San Francisco, Santa Clara, Riverside, to name a few in California, do still have to use their bond schedule because it is required under California state law. But for individuals who are released on their own recognizance, the judges have an option of sending them to pretrial services, where pretrial services officers use risk assessment instruments and different supervision strategies to be able to more successfully ensure their return to court and make it less likely that they'll commit a new crime.
And Shane, can you give us a sense of how we got to this system? You write about it in your article, and actually the roots of the bail bond system are right here in San Francisco.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about bail bonds is it's something that most of us just take for granted. We've always had bail bondsmen, you know, through all of our lives, and it's really actually a very kind of unique system. We're the only country other than the Philippines that has commercial bail. There's nowhere else that it's actually a for-profit industry. So in some sense, it's kind of the oldest privatized part of our criminal justice system. It did start in San Francisco. It started kind of, in just after the frontier days, where, you know, it used to be that there was bail. A judge would set bail, and, you know, a friend or a neighbor might put up that bail amount, and when you go back to court, that person gets the money back. And as you know, the kind of frontier was spreading, areas were getting more spread out, people weren't settled down, they didn't have these kind of communities that they once had, so it was harder to get people to put up money. And what happened was, in San Francisco, kind of the end of the 19th century, there were a couple brothers, the McDonough brothers, who worked in San Francisco off Kearney Street in their father's bar, and there would be lawyers that would come in, and as a kind of a favor to their loyal customers, these brothers would sometimes put up bail money for them, and they would get it back when their clients came out. And as they were doing that, they kind of came up with the idea that, well, maybe they could charge a fee to offer this money up, and they did. And when their father died, they kind of tore the bar out of the building and made it the first bail bonds business. And it later kind of became notorious as a center of corruption in the city. They had a lot of power, and you know, they were eventually shut down in the early 20th century. But by that time, the business had kind of spread across the country.
And that's the case now. But there were moves for reform. And in 1960, there was something, a research project called the Manhattan Bail Project, where researchers did a test and found that less than 2% of the pretrial detainees released without bail were failing to appear for court, meaning that most people would show up for trial even if they didn't have to put up money. So tell us a little bit about these kind of reform movements.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the origins of the pretrial services that Megan was talking about. The Manhattan Bail Project kind of showed that, you know, there is a way to kind of assess the risk of most people, you know, how likely they will be to return to trial based on different factors like, you know, how much ties they have to the community, you know, whether they have a house, whether they go to school. After that Manhattan Bail Project, which was the first attempt to do that, and a successful attempt, kind of other projects start mimicking that around the country, and have since spread all over the country. And this is kind of really the big kind of counter option to commercial bail right now, especially for kind of low level offenders. And the bail industry, you know, what I found in doing this investigation is the bail industry really does not like pretrial services. They see them as a really big threat to their business, the main threat to their business. And there are some states since the Manhattan Bail Project that have abolished commercial bail. There's 4 states that do not allow commercial bail right now in the country. So, you know, the bail industry has a lobby, and a powerful lobby that kind of, they have a national lobby and many local lobbies, and the national lobby will kind of go to different states and try to pass laws that restrict these pretrial services so that they kind of still maintain customer base, essentially.
And we'll talk more about that industry in just a minute. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about the system of bail and whether it is so discriminatory of the poor that it should be reformed. That's a question that we're asking today. We're joined by Shane Bauer, who's a reporter with Mother Jones in San Francisco, and he's the author of Get Out of Jail Free, Lobbyists, Guns, and Money Inside the Shadowy and Very Well-Connected Bail Bonds Industry that is in the current issue of Mother Jones. We're also joined by Megan Guevara, who's a consultant with the Pretrial Justice Institute. And Megan, I wanted to turn to you and hear more about the people who are sitting in our jails, people who can't even afford the 10% to pay a bondsman. So they're waiting for trial, supposedly innocent until proven guilty. That's two-thirds of the 750,000 people sitting in jails in America are there because they can't afford to pay the bail. So tell us, who are these people? What kinds of crimes have they allegedly committed?
It's a very wide diversity of people, ranging from individuals with very low-level drug offenses, all the way up to individuals who have committed very serious crimes. And as you mentioned earlier, the bail system really holds them there, not based on their risk of committing a new crime were they to be released into the community, but based on their ability to pay the bond that has been given to them. So you may have one individual who's committed one nonviolent offense who is sitting in jail awaiting disposition, and during that time not able to maintain their job, not able to take care of their children and families, potentially putting their housing and other connections to the community at risk while they're sitting and waiting in jail. And conversely, you may have another very serious offender who had a $500,000 bond, who had access to money, and who is walking the streets because they were simply able to post the bond for the serious crime that they committed.
And
one of the...
Go ahead.
And I was just going to add that what the science of pretrial justice and the use of risk assessment is able to tell us is which of those folks is truly able or truly poses a risk to public safety or is truly able to function successfully in the community awaiting trial based on other factors besides just the charge that they're before the court on.
And the studies have shown that if you are in jail in pretrial detention, you're much more likely to be found guilty. Can you explain some of the reasons behind that?
Sure. And we know that this is especially a risk for lower risk offenders, people who are less likely to commit a new crime. But the fact that you're in jail and you're separated from your positive supports in the community, you're less able to advocate for yourself in terms of putting together your defense. You're more likely to appear before a jury in a jumpsuit and shackles and create a negative image, whether that's consciously or subconsciously, in the minds of jurors. And you're less able to talk about the positive things that you're doing in the community and make the case for why you should be back out as a result of your incarceration pretrial. So we haven't been able to establish a direct causal relationship through the research yet, but we do know that individuals who are detained pretrial are more likely to get sent to prison overall and more likely to have longer prison sentences than similarly situated individuals who are able to remain in the community pretrial.
That's
and
Megan.
We also know through recent research. Yes?
Go ahead. You also know from recent research?
That the longer a low-risk person stays in jail pretrial, the more damaging the impact that jail stay has on them.
Megan Guevara is a consultant with the Pretrial Justice Institute. We're also joined by Shane Bauer, who's a reporter with Mother Jones, and he's written the article in the current edition of Mother Jones, Get Out of Jail Free, Lobbyists, Guns, and Money Inside the Shadowy and Very Well-Connected Bail Bonds Industry. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're now joined by Michaela Davis, who's the Criminal Justice and Drug Policy Attorney at the ACLU of Northern California. Welcome, Michaela.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So as you just heard, we're talking about some of the collateral problems that pretrial detention creates. From your research here in California, what have you found?
We found much the same thing, that the pretrial detention system poses both a public safety risk and a threat to civil liberties. Many of the things that Megan just noted, we also see in the research that defendants that await trial, while they are detained, are more likely to be sentenced to jail and prison, are more likely to go back to prison and jail and commit new crimes later. And so we're looking at not just the time someone spends waiting trial, but also there are severe after effects. And the bottom line is that the focus on money bail rather than any meaningful assessment or evaluation of risk means that many people who present little to no public safety or failure to appear danger remain unnecessarily behind bars pending trial. This is especially important in California, where after realignment, which was put into place 2 years ago, counties are now responsible for low-level offenders. And so county jails are facing big problems with overcrowding, just as the state has with the overcrowding crisis. And so it really is an opportunity for the counties to look at how can we do things different. How do we make smart decisions about who needs to be detained prior to trial and who can be safely supervised in the community?
And let's talk a little bit about how we might do things differently. In just a moment, let me invite listeners to join our conversation about the bail bonds system. If you've been affected, if you've had to pay a bail bondsman, we'd love to hear about your experience. The number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. If you work in the bail bond system, what do you think about proposals to reform it? What do you think works and doesn't work with the current system, and what's your experience? And if you have an idea for reform of the bail system that will still ensure public safety, let us know about it. Is the idea of guilty until proven innocent unconstitutional? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you go to our website, yourcallradio.org, you can post comments there and see all of the material that we're talking about on the program. So right before I invited listeners, you were talking about how we might do things differently. And we're talking a lot about the human impact of this, the impact on justice. But I just wanted to also point out the impact to taxpayers. We're paying $9 billion to house people in pretrial detention, which is a lot of money. So, Michaela, what are some of the calls for reform that you're hearing? What are some of the ideas?
Well, right. So one clear thing is the state legislature needs to get involved and mandate pretrial reform on a statewide level. One reform that we have sponsored in connection with Lonnie Hancock's office in the past 2 years has been a bill that would expand the presumption of OR release that currently exists for misdemeanors.
That's own reconnaissance?
Yes, own reconnaissance release, where you don't pay bail and it's essentially a promise to appear. Currently, that OR release, the presumption exists for misdemeanors. We would like to expand that presumption of OR release to those charged with nonviolent, non-serious felonies. And so that would mean, if you, say, came in with a drug possession charge, a nonviolent, non-serious felony, it would be presumed that you would be released on your own recognizance unless the judge made a finding on the record that such release would endanger public safety or that you had a high failure, a high risk of failing to appear. That change that we've proposed in the state legislature was opposed by the law enforcement lobby, and has not been successful as of yet. And additional county-based reforms include counties mandating use of evidence-based validated risk assessment tools, as Ms. Guevara was talking about. We also want to make sure that defendants are represented by counsel at initial appearance, that counties are providing adequate staffing and training for those who are doing the assessments of defendants. And lastly, the state needs to mandate data collection and analysis so that we know what's working and what's not in these various pretrial programs across the state.
And we'll talk more about proposals for reform and some of the impediments to changing the system. And we'll also look at where they have changed the system, for example, D.C. But let's go to a caller. Let's go to Mary in Salinas. Hi, Mary. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thank you, Rose, for covering this topic. Yeah, I'm sorry I missed most of it, but I will tell you that working in the community with people of all walks, one of the things that I find, especially with the whole system, the way it's set up, it's very much set up against people who are uneducated or, uninformed with the way laws work and impoverished. They put warrants on people that have high warrant appearance demands. I mean, to somebody else, maybe $10,000 or $25,000 might not seem like a lot of money, but when you have to put down 10%, come up with 10%, and then start, you know, go to a bail bondsman and start, you know, giving them ownership of your property, it, all of this stuff is very much impacts on the, you know, on the community members who then later on, the whole system is just rigged from phone calls, what they charge on phone calls through the system. You can pay as much as $23 for a phone call. People's rights are being violated before they ever have an opportunity to make it in front of a judge. And once you start falling into that system, it's very difficult to dig your way out, as you find with so many youth who and then they go to public defenders who are also impacted with the cost. They don't have enough money put into the system for them. They give them advice many times. It's, well, you either agree to this or you could end up with, you know, 20 years in prison. And they're scared. They end up pleading to things. They end up going on probation. They get their probations get violated very easy. It's just all rigged. And I see it as a system that feeds upon the very poor. Well, to feed into law enforcement.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Mary. So she's pointing out that it seems to be preying on the poor who end up trapped in this system that it's hard to dig out. Shane, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's the poor that are ultimately impacted by this, and I think this is why, you know, it's important to kind of get into, you know, the kind of profit, you know, draw that's behind this, because ultimately we're talking about people that can't raise that $2,000 is going to break the bank, you know.
Or there's even people who can't get a $500 together.
Exactly. Yeah, and you have to remember that these are people that have not been found guilty. You know, we some are innocent, some are guilty, and they're having to pay this money or stay in jail and you know, potentially lose their jobs and not be able to, you know, feed their family.
And how many of these people are non-violent offenders? Anybody know?
It varies from community to community, and that's why it's really important to make sure that counties know who's in their jail, because very often if you ask county officials, give us a breakdown of that jail population, who are the non-violent offenders, or what is the risk level of the people in your jails, no one has that information. So a really important first step is to make sure that counties are paying attention to who's in jail and who's sitting there for a little while. If judges assume they're going to be able to make a low bond and they're going to be back on the street and they're not, they're sitting in jail for long periods of time, often no one's paying attention to that.
And we're speaking with Megan Guevara, who's a consultant with the Pretrial Justice Institute. We were also joined by Michaela Davis, who's a criminal justice and drug policy attorney with the ACLU of Northern California, and Shane Bauer, who's a Mother Jones reporter and author of the new article, Get Out of Jail Free, which is all about the bail bonds industry, its effect on the poor, and questioning its effect on our justice system. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're scrutinizing the bail bond system and its effect on justice, and we want to hear from you. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. How would you reform the bail system and still ensure public safety? And if you've been affected on either end, if you work in the bail bonds industry, or if you're somebody who's had to pay a bond, give us a call. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. Join the conversation, 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-TALK, or you can send an email question or comment to feedback at yourcallradio.org.
I'm hanging around this ocean. Sometimes I feel so sad. I ain't got the money to take me back.
In Trinidad, $1 buy papaya juice.
I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow we'll talk about how do we respond to misogyny in everyday life. We're going to talk about the terrible murders near Santa Barbara last Friday that left 6 dead and 13 wounded. Millions of people have responded on Twitter since the event, speaking about the culture of misogyny that pervades their lives. So what conversations do we need to be having about gender discrimination, harassment, and outright violence? Today we're talking about the bail bond industry. Roughly two-thirds of people in U.S. jails are stuck there because they can't afford to pay bail. Critics say the bail bond system disproportionately affects the poor and justice. So is it time for reform? And who's making money in this multi-billion dollar industry? If you want to join our conversation, the number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're joined by Megan Guevara, who's a consultant with the Pretrial Justice Institute. She works with local and state justice systems to develop policies that reduce the likelihood of new crime and maximize taxpayer dollars. Also joining us is Shane Bauer, who's a reporter with Mother Jones, and his article is in the current issue, Get Out of Jail Free, Lobbyists, Guns, and Money Inside the Shadowy and Very Well-Connected Bail Bonds Industry. So, Shane, let's talk about the bail bonds industry and let's follow the money. How powerful is this lobby?
Well, I think to start, the important thing to understand is that bail agents are basically insurance agents. You know, they're insuring the state, the court, that their client is going to appear. So behind all of these kind of bail offices, you know, that you see around jails, there are big insurance companies. There's about 30 that work in bail, and really just a handful that are the main companies. These insurance companies draw funds from every bail agent. In most states, bail agents have to be backed by these large surety companies that have a large amount of money that can, you know, essentially bail out the bondsman if their client doesn't show up and they don't have the money to pay up to the court. So these are national insurance companies. And
like which companies?
You know, they're not insurance companies that you would have heard of.
Okay.
They mostly deal in you know, bail. They're not, it's not like, you know, State Farm or something like that. But there was a period of time where this pretrial services were really gaining ground across the country, and the industry profits were actually falling. And so what happened, I met with several of the heads of these insurance companies, and, you know, they talk about in the early 90s kind of getting together. You know, these guys compete with each other, but they kind of came together and said, we have to do something about this. And they formed an organization called the American Bail Coalition. And when you look back at the kind of early literature of this organization, they talk about the jihad against commercial bail, and it's very kind of you know, warlike language. And so they kind of joined forces, and then they teamed up with the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which is kind of a conservative organization where companies like Walmart, you know, huge corporations, come in and they actually write model pieces of legislation, and they then kind of pass on those pieces of legislation to legislators, which are also members of ALEC. So the bail industry joined this organization and start writing laws, you know, and legislators were taking them back to their states.
What kinds of laws?
Laws that, for example, increase, you know, the types of crimes that require a defendant to post surety bail, which is essentially commercial bail. You know, there's a set of crimes where the judge can kind of make the call, and then there's a set of crimes where states say this person, you know, has to have a surety bond, which is a money bond. And for the most part, those end up being commercial bail bonds. They've also attempted in some states to get rid of, to make it so that almost all offenses require bail bonds. In Colorado, for example, the bail industry formed an organization which appeared to be a kind of grassroots tough-on-crime organization that was pushing for a very strong bill that would have essentially mandated commercial bail for almost everything. And they were not kind of disclosing that these were they were representatives of the bail surety companies. And they actually got this on the ballot, and it was voted down, so they didn't succeed there. But since this kind of big lobbying efforts have started, commercial bail has the use of commercial bail has increased quite a bit. In the early 90s, for felony offenses, most people were still released on their own recognizance. Now most people are released on commercial bail. Bail rates, you know, the amount of money you have to put down for to get out, have almost tripled since 1990. So we're seeing a really strengthening of this industry since that time. And there's ways that there's the national level, but there's also kind of a lot of local efforts. I found, for example, in Louisiana, a lobby made it so that everybody who gets out, you know, not only do they pay their 10% fee to the bail bondsman, but they pay an additional 2% on top of that. And that money is allocated to the sheriff's department, the judges, and the district attorney. So, I talked to the person who had worked in this lobby, and he said, you know, our intention was basically to ensure that commercial bail does not become illegal here, because we're making it so that all these different parts of the judicial system have a financial interest in maintaining commercial bail.
And so, Megan, how hard is it then to push back and advocate for pretrial services in lieu of commercial bail as this industry grows stronger, more powerful, and becomes immersed in, you know, embedded in the very system of justice?
It is a very difficult uphill battle because of the lobbying power of the bonds industry. But in Colorado, for example, both the local pretrial community, with support from Pretrial Justice Institute and other national partners, were able to get pretrial legislation passed despite pushback from the bond industry that now requires the use of a pretrial risk assessment instrument throughout the state. And so we're starting to see the benefits of that here in my home state of Colorado. So it is not a task that cannot be successfully completed. And I think that in California, as Michaela mentioned, because of realignment and because of other ways that the system is looking for new solutions around pretrial and around the management of jail populations, that there are lots of folks that are willing to take that cause up and are interested in pushing back in Sacramento and throughout the state.
And let's go to another caller. Let's go to Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Welcome to your call.
Hi. I was just wanting to let you know that the San Francisco Pretrial Diversion Project really is a very inclusive and successful program. I have unfortunately been in a very low income bracket for a lot of years, and while much of that had to do with alcoholism, the system never really targeted and figured out that, you know, this guy is not a criminal, he's just a drunk. Well, I've been sober now for 5.5 years, and I'm still grateful to San Francisco Pretrial Diversion for getting me out of jail on some pretty serious charges, and actually putting me up when I was homeless in a room until on my court date, which then led me to get housed other ways, and I've been actually housed ever since.
So when you were jailed at that point, you were homeless?
Yes, and they actually have a gentleman that works for them that, you know, if they have somebody that they've released on pretrial diversion and they're homeless, he will go around to where they hang out and look for them to show up for court if they need to. And they are very interactive with people. They get them engaged in groups and various things to help them address their issues.
And it sounds like it was a real success for you. How are you doing today?
Today, you know, most of all my legal troubles went away when I quit drinking. I'm one of those people who, you know, I drink and I'm so allergic I break out in handcuffs.
Well, thank you for sharing your experience, and we're so glad to hear that it had a positive outcome. Shane, right before we went to Robert, who's clearly an example of pretrial diversion working and working very well, and it sounds more cost effective, but you sounded like you wanted to add something to what Megan was saying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was going to say that there are also people, senators, including in Colorado, that are also bail agents. You know, I was really surprised to find this in a lot of states, and this, the bail agent that I'm thinking of in Colorado was a part of this campaign to strengthen commercial bail. In South Dakota, I found a senator who brought, he was a new senator. He went for the first time to an ALEC gathering, and he brought back one of these model bills the bail industry had written to his state, which was, it's actually a pretty new thing that the bail industry is doing, which is trying to use bail for post-conviction. So after somebody is convicted, letting them out of jail on the condition that they, you know, post a bail through a commercial bail bondsman, which, you know, for a bail bondsman is great. It's a whole, you know, doubling business, essentially. So this senator brought this bill back. You know, he kind of explained this whole story where he gave the bill to his colleague and got it passed in his state. And he has offices across the Midwest, you know. And he spoke very frankly at the ALEC meeting about, you know, it being good business for him.
And Shane, what is the argument that somebody who's pro-commercial bail make for the system? Do they say that there is a correlation between the bail bond system and public safety?
Yes. The argument to the bail industry is that bail agents have a financial incentive to go after people who don't appear for court because they're putting their own money on the line, essentially. So, you know, if they basically, you know, promise the court their client is going to come. If their client doesn't come, they have to put up the whole bail amount. It's the way that the system is supposed to work. And so if their client doesn't show, they have to find him or her and bring them back.
And that's where we see, like, bounty hunters, for example.
Exactly.
What regulation is there of that kind of behavior, that sort of law enforcement aspect?
See, you know, it varies state to state, but the bounty hunters in some ways have powers that police don't have. You know, they can, in some states, enter the home of somebody who's one of their clients without a warrant. You know, some states they can use guns. I followed a case in Virginia where a bail agent had shot a client of his who was, you know, out on a non-violent offense, and this agent had been kind of tied up in a lot of kind of shady scenarios, and his client didn't show up for a drug test, and he came to his house and shot him. There's very little training. I mean, it's in Virginia, it was like 5 days of training, $400, and you can become a bail bondsman that is licensed to carry a weapon on the job.
And I know you went to a training convention. We'll hear about that in a minute. Shane Bauer is a reporter with Mother Jones, and his article on the bail bonds system is in the current issue of Mother Jones, Get Out of Jail Free, Lobbyists, Guns, and Money Inside the Shadowy and Very Well-Connected Bail Bonds Industry. We're also joined by Megan Guevara, who is with the Pretrial Justice Institute, and we want to invite you to join our conversation. Do you think that the bail bond system needs reform? Is the idea of guilty until proven innocent unconstitutional in our current system, where two-thirds of the people in U.S. jails are there because they can't pay a bail bond fee? 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number. That number again is 866-798-8255. And if you work in the bail bond industry yourself, we'd love to hear from you and how you experience this system, what you think are the pros and cons of it, and if you'd be open to any reforms. 866-798-8255. 8255 is the toll-free number. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. And Megan, it seems like the bail bonds industry is an archaic system in this time of so much technology, and in particular ankle bracelets that seem like they would be much more cost-effective than the current system. What's your thought on that?
There's a variety of different technologies that are available, and honestly, the most basic and most effective tool is just a reminder system, so that when we call people and remind them to come to court the same way your dentist or your doctor does, they're a lot more likely to show up, and it can be as basic as that. There is some research behind electronic monitoring as a tool to be able to keep track of folks in the community, but it's also important that it's used sparingly. It's also possible to over-supervise individuals who would be just fine without any tracking in the community. And electronic monitoring also raises expense concerns, since generally defendants are responsible for the cost of those ankle bracelets themselves, and some folks are left in jail simply because they're given the option of EM and can't afford whatever the fee is per month to be able to use it. So in the grand scheme of things, is it better for somebody to be out on electronic monitoring rather than be in jail if they're at a low risk to reoffend? Yes, but we also need to be very careful that we're not transferring the cost of technology and making it, again, more likely that someone's going to end up in a more expensive jail bed simply because they can't pay.
And can you tell us how Washington, D.C. ended up abolishing the bail bond system? Since 1992, more than 80% of defendants are released before trial. Only 12% fail to appear for at least one court hearing. So how did D.C. end the bond system?
Sure. They put in place a two-part system, one of which is having the ability to preventatively detain individuals, so a very small percentage of folks who are deemed to not be safely supervised in the community are still able to be held in jail, and that helps protect public safety. And then they have a continuum of supervision options. So they have some individuals who are simply released on their own recognizance, and then some who are released to the pretrial services program, where they're given a range of supervision that can include drug testing, include checking in with a pretrial services officer, and having somebody that is keeping tabs on them, but in a way that's based on their risk level, not on their ability to post a bond and be out in the community with the bondsman. And in some ways, it just takes strength of political will to put that kind of system in place. It's something that's available to communities across the country, but we do have the science of risk assessment to be able to know what level of supervision an individual needs and to be able to more successfully predict using those tools whether somebody can be successful in the community or not. And that's how D.C. has been able to put that kind of system in place and show positive outcomes and show that you don't need money in order to keep the community safe and to truly consider someone innocent until proven guilty.
And let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Pat in Berkeley. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I was arrested a few years ago on a real serious charge I was completely innocent of, but it was a weekend, and they set the bail at $30,000. And I knew I was going to have the charges dismissed, but I didn't want my wife to pay $3,000 to this bail bondsman. It was much more money than I would have made over the weekend. So she called a few friends of mine, and they hustled the money up, and it took them 8 hours to count it in the at the jail, but they eventually let me go that same day. And then I got all the money back without having to pay any of it to the county or to anyone else or the court even. So I was wondering, is there any efforts to use crowdfunding or some other source of revenue for people who, are likely to get all the money back but just don't have it on hand?
That's a fascinating concept. Stay on the line with us, Pat. What about this idea that Pat has to use crowdsourcing so that people can put up bail and everybody gets the money back?
In those states where commercial surety has been abolished, the deposit bond is a concept that's being used, where instead of paying your 10% fee to the bondsman, you just pay it to the court. And if you return, then you get that money back. So the court doesn't care what methods you use to be able to get that money together. So if you're able to use crowdfunding, friends and family, to be able to support you and raise those funds. As long as you can pay that deposit bond to the court, then you're eligible to get that money back and repay other individuals. That would be a personal decision, but it allows the commercial surety industry to be out of the picture in terms of how those funds are raised.
Well, thanks very much for calling and sharing your experience, Pat. Shane, I wanted to get a little bit more into how the smaller bail bond outfits work. I mean, you see those offices all over town, especially near jails. Who are these bail bondsmen? Who are these mom-and-pop operations?
I mean, I think there are a lot of different people. There's kind of huge bail bonds companies like Aladdin Bail Bonds, and then there's a lot of the kind of mom and pop, you know, bail agents that's family business. I went to a bail bonds convention in Las Vegas, and I met people across that spectrum. You know, people that were their fathers with their sons that they were kind of grooming to become bail bondsmen. And they had other sons that were their bounty hunters, you know. And then there was, you know, Dog the Bounty Hunter on the other end, which is this kind of famous.
That's a reality TV star.
Right. And he, you know, gets jobs all over the country to hunt down fugitives, you know, people that skipped court and didn't, you know, have to pay their bail.
And you were undercover when you went to the bail bondsman training convention. What insight did you get from that experience?
You know, it was interesting just to kind of sit and listen and see kind of what the industry is talking about. You know, there were some kind of just tricks of the trade stuff. There was a private investigator that gave a long seminar about, you know, how to use things like Facebook to track people. He recommended that bail agents start requiring their clients' Facebook passwords when they, as a condition of getting them out of jail now, so that if they escape, they have an easier way to find them. He suggested that people start using hobby drones. He gave an example of using a drone when there's kind of a long driveway and a barking dog. Instead of going down there, just fly a drone in and get the license plates of the cars that are there.
Wow.
They use these companies that that kind of track license plates that just drive around and store data of where different cars are. And the bondsmen actually work with them a lot. These companies market themselves as to kind of repo companies, you know, that need somebody has to repossess a car. They search this database, find where the car was. But bondsmen also use it. They pay a fee if they're looking for somebody. You know, they just kind of, you know, search the license plate number and find them.
So the industry's going pretty high tech. As we move into just the last couple of minutes of the program, I wanted to move to some of the solutions being proposed, the prospects for real reform, especially here in California. And in the Justice Policy Institute put out a report called Bail Fail, and some of the recommendations that they made was to eliminate money bail, amend the Bail Reform Act so that it complies with the Equal Protection Clause, use citations and summons to reduce the number of people being arrested and processed through jails, use standardized, validized risk assessments like what Megan has been talking about. So, Megan, let's start with you. What solutions are you proposing, and what do you think the prospects for real reform are?
I think the prospects now are better than they have been. The science has been advancing for years, and there's so much more interest in this issue even over the past 2 years than in the decades before that. So I think there's a lot of momentum that we need to take advantage of. And we have these science-based solutions. We have risk assessment instruments. We have supervision practices that have been evaluated and other means to be able to successfully maintain individuals in the community that are much more fair. They're much more likely to maintain public safety than anything that's been used historically in a money bond system. And we have communities that are using those tools now and are evaluating them and proving them successful. So anything from implementing a risk assessment instrument to implementing a reminder telephone system can be beneficial in terms of getting people back to court. And in individual communities, just starting by looking at who's in your jail and making sure you know who's there, that you're giving your judges feedback about the impact that their decisions are making or having, that you know about the disparities that bail bonds or your current system may be putting in place in your jails. Just start by coming together as a community and having that conversation about what is the goal of our pretrial system, are we actually achieving those goals, and who are the people that we may be inadvertently hurting.
And Shane, just about a minute left to get your final thoughts. Megan says there's momentum for reform right now.
Yeah, I think like a lot of the criminal justice system, we now have plenty of data showing what works and what doesn't work, how much different things cost. It costs a lot of money to keep people in jail, and we have good alternatives, you know, to this money bail system. An outcome of this money bail system is we end up having a lot more people in jail because they can't afford to get out. 89% of people who are in jail pretrial are there because they can't afford bail. And, you know, we have these alternatives. We've been using them for a long time. And, you know, we just need to kind of look at that and make an assessment.
And just quickly, what do you think are the biggest obstacles to reform after really reporting on this multi-billion dollar lobby?
I think the industry and the lobby is the largest obstacle to reform now. I mean, we have examples. We have places that with successful, you know, pretrial services, and there are other places that are up against a lot because the industry is giving a lot of resistance.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Shane Bauer is a reporter with Mother Jones Magazine, and his current article is in this edition of Mother Jones, Get Out of Jail Free. We have a link to that and all of the information you've heard here at yourcallradio.org. We were also joined by Megan Guevara, who's a consultant with the Pretrial Justice Institute. Thank you for joining us. And I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. How do we respond to misogyny in everyday life? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the terrible shootings near Santa Barbara last Friday that left 6 dead and 13 wounded. The shooter targeted a sorority in part because he felt beautiful women had rejected him. Millions of people have commented on Twitter speaking about the culture of misogyny that pervades their lives. So what conversations do we need to be having about gender discrimination, harassment, and outright violence? Join the conversation on Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.